Let's start with the easy one. How would you describe our current cultural definition of romantic love?
Well, I think that we have constrained our imaginations in how we think about love. We think about it in the same breath with, you know, romance and marriage. And I think that inadvertently limits our potential to experience love and to benefit from those experiences.
In your book, Love 2.0, you have a new definition of love. What is it?
Well, I focus on the micro moments that we experience love as an emotion. And I argue that love is that moment of connection that you feel when you look into someone's eyes, you're feeling the same way, and you momentarily have a sense of mutual concern for one another. Now, that kind of a moment is certainly a lot milder than lightning bolt love at first sight or romance, but it's the kind of micro moment that nourishes us over time and helps us become healthier, happier, better versions of ourselves. And that can happen between you, you know, these kind of micro moments can happen between you and your soulmate or you and a complete stranger. It's just the way our bodies are wired.
So love, by definition of Love 2.0, is both more and less than love as it appears in a Valentine's Day card.
Exactly. It's just it's a very different way of looking at it. I'm not saying that romance doesn't exist. I'm just saying that we may have our eyes on the wrong piece of the love puzzle, and the really consequential piece in terms of our health may be these micro moments of connection. And these micro moments of connection are also what build our lasting relationships. So they're good for the body and they're good for our relationships. They're sort of the building blocks of many other things.
Let me divide it out for a moment if I can. How do I know when one of these moments is happening?
Yeah, I think it's when you get the sense that you and another person are on the same page or on the same wavelength or, you know, of the same mindset. Really connecting. It's what we commonly will call rapport. You know, we had really good rapport. We were really, you know, building off of each other's ideas and so on. So that can happen, and we know we can have rapport with complete strangers and people that we know really well. The reason I think rapport misses the mark is that rapport sounds like something we'd be just as healthy with or without. It doesn't sound like a vital nutrient that keeps us alive and healthy. So that's why I think we've missed the mark in just calling it rapport, because that sounds sort of superfluous, optional.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at the other side of it then. Once I know that one of these things has occurred, it may make me feel good, but feeling good has a couple of different definitions too. Is there something physically happening when you have one of those positive moments?
Definitely. One of the reasons why the emotion, taking an emotions perspective on love, is so helpful is that all emotions, by definition, are potent mind and body events. They're not just an idea rolling through your minds. They're at the same time changing your biochemistry, changing your gestures, changing your neural firings. And when two people are experiencing this micro moment of connection, then there's something very interesting unfolding across two brains and bodies at once. People's neural firings become synchronized, their gestures become synchronized, their biochemical reactions become synchronized, to the point where it becomes a real open question. Is this love happening for just one person, or is it something that's happening across two brains and bodies at once? And I think that it's more helpful to look at love as the connection between two people and happening across two people at once. So there's definitely a myriad of physical changes that go with it.
Hmm. I mean, I've had experiences like this. I have images in my mind of my grandson arriving at the house and throwing his arms wide, and I can feel the whole world start to open up.
Exactly.
it's easy there. But is it also that same thing that's happening if I smile at a stranger on the street and they smile back?
That's a milder version, I would say, yeah, because a smile comes with a certain brain activation behind it. And when you catch somebody else's smile, you're mirroring not just what's muscle movements are showing up on your face. There's a deeper mirroring going on where your brain activation is more similar to each other than it was a moment before that smile occurred. So that smile on the street is a smaller, milder version of the connection you feel with your grandson when he runs towards you with a hug.
So what sets the stage for that? It's easy for me to see with my grandson, okay?
Not
as easy to see with someone I've never met and never will again.
Right. You know what? I think there are two preconditions that set the stage for these micro moments of connection to unfold. And those are feelings of safety and physical connection or physical co-presence, you know, that you're in the same place at the same time. Now, you can get that, we can build rapport right here on the, you know, through a voice connection. So the phone can work really well that way. But the more disconnected or mediated our communications with others are, the less likely we are to be feeling the same thing at the same time, because we're not prepared to catch each other's emotions by making eye contact or voice contact.
Does this change the way we experience the world, do you think?
I think it really does. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is because it gives you a whole new set of lenses for seeing every interaction. Every interaction with others becomes an opportunity to both get and give nourishment, or to become better versions of ourselves, an opportunity to connect. And we find that simply asking people at the end of each day whether they felt connected or attuned with the people they spent time with is enough to set off some changes that lead to changes in cardiovascular health. That just thinking about connections is enough to make changes in how people are faring in the world.
Is some of this chemical? I mean, we used to talk about getting a rush from having a good feeling about somebody else. You feel, I know, it's not just adrenaline, there are other things, oxytocin,
right.
Brain chemicals.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. There's a whole biochemical cascade that comes unleashed with all emotions, and love is no different. The effects are sometimes subtle, and they take patience as a scientist to uncover, but we're beginning to see those effects, again, in a kind of a synchronized way, unfolding between people at the same time.
Is it does it bother you at all to use the word love to cover all of these things? I'm enjoying the thought of being healthier and stronger because I smile at somebody on the street, but it's hard for me to put that in the same category as that joy I feel when my son walks into the room, or my grandson, or my wife, or memories of my parents.
It is difficult to take on a word like love, because people have so many strong pre-existing views of it, hard-won views, that come from personal experience and just absorbing our cultural messages as well. And it's also difficult because we use love in common language to describe so many different things and so many different kinds of relationships. And I see my job as a scientist to try to look at cause and effect and what leads to what, and to use words more precisely when I can. And so I see these micro moments of connection as being the real heart of a broader love system. And that love system includes our long-lasting relationships, our feeling of trust and loyalty and bondedness with others. And yet, if I look at what drives those longer enduring states of trust and loyalty and relationships, the science tells me it's these micro moments of positive connection. Now, to be more precise, I don't call any of them love. I call the longer relationships bonds, and these micro moments, the jargon phrase for them is positivity resonance. But love is, I think, it's worthy of describing these micro moments of positivity resonance as love, because they seem to be what drive the whole system and keep it going. And they're the actionable pieces. You can actually decide, I want to feel more connected with people today, and make a change in how you interact with people and achieve that. Whereas if you say, well, I want more love relationships today, that's going to be tougher to act on.
Well, then it implies a whole different thing. Whereas what you're talking about is an improved sense of positive relationships with people. It's both bigger and smaller again.
Right. I agree. It's bigger and smaller. It's bigger in terms of our potential to have some control about whether and when we feel these states, because if we understand the preconditions, we can create those preconditions. And it's smaller because it takes love off that pedestal of being high romance or only reserved for our loved ones. And it says, no, actually, love is something about how we connect with people, everybody, not just our loved ones.
When you're studying this, of course, you have to find ways to analyze it. You have to find terms, as you've said. You have to use the right word at the right time. But you also need to be able to study the physiological benefits of love, of positivity resonance. Is that the phrase you were using?
Yes.
Are there elements that you can measure? Is vagal tone something to do with the nerve that connects to the brain? Something
right.
You can measure?
Yes, vagal tone is something that we've done quite a bit of research with in my research group, and that is the 10th cranial nerve that connects your brain to your heart and other internal organs, and you can measure the functioning or the strength or vigor of the vagus nerve by looking at how heart rate and breathing rates are attuned or yoked to one another. And a pattern of high vagal tone is one where your heart rate speeds up a little bit when you're breathing in and slows down a little bit when you're breathing out. And that's a very subtle arrhythmia in heart rate, a healthy arrhythmia in heart rate, a very subtle one. And that having this higher vagal tone is like high muscle tone. It's good for you to have high vagal tone. And it signals flexibility and adaptability in how our body regulates internal biological systems and how our minds regulate attention and emotion. So it's really a good predictor of both psychological and physical health. And we find then when we measure people's vagal tone before and after, we teach them approaches to increasing their daily diet of positivity resonance, that their vagal tone improves. And the active ingredient in that improvement is the connection they feel with others on a daily basis.
So tell me a little bit about this before and after. You found that people can actually increase the amount of love, this amount of positivity in their lives?
Definitely. And I first stumbled onto this some years ago when I was looking for ways to test a theory I have on, you know, what good are positive emotions in the long term. And I had tried a number of different strategies that should have worked to help people increase their positive emotions, but didn't. And around that time, I was learning more about integrative medicine and became acquainted with an ancient form of meditation practice called loving-kindness meditation, or metta in Pali. And this is, you know, 2,500 years old, honed over millennia to help people form more positive connections with other people. And I thought, this could allow me to test my theory. And at the time, my theory was just about positive emotions in general. But working with this very potent ancient meditation technique has convinced me that shared experiences of positive emotions or positivity resonance may actually be even more important than other positive emotions. Other positive emotions are certainly important. I've made my career studying, you know, the good that they do for people, but these ones that we share with others seem to hold a special capacity to make us healthier and wiser and more connected.
So where does what we ordinarily, culturally think of as love fit into this? You mentioned bonding. Is that does that sort of put our romantic version of love in its place?
That's where I would position it. I think that what I'm arguing here is that there's a broader spectrum of love, and sometimes these shared micro moments are leading to strong bonds, lifelong bonds, and, you know, commitments of loyalty to others. And in those cases, we're seeing them go hand in hand. But in other times, these moments of shared positivity, positivity resonance, may help us feel connected to our communities more generally, not so much connected with just one person, but they make us feel part of something larger, part of a neighborhood, part of a town. Those are two different things that these micro moments can do. I think if we limit ourselves to just thinking of love in terms of romance and long-term bonds, we're just seeing part of the picture.
So it's okay to say, I love my community, I love my friends, I love my football team?
You know, people do that all the time. And so in a way, our language is pulling us in that direction. But I don't think it's important that people use the L word to describe these micro moments. What I think is important is that we see these micro moments of positive connection as nourishment, as important, and that we see them as a way to connect and a way to be giving and a way to make ourselves and others healthier. So I seek to elevate them. Now, some people may continue to be uncomfortable calling that love, and that's okay. I just want to raise the point that, well, actually, maybe it is. This is a vital building block that we should be paying more attention to.
Bigger again, in a sense, but it does. It's a little worrisome. The redefinition of love you've presented in some ways bursts the popular myths about love, that it is only between two people or between family members, or that it's a lasting state. Because it seems to me that perhaps if it is a collection of positive moments, there could be a dispersion of positive moments.
Right. And so we can see the importance in our cherished relationships of making sure we keep the gateways open to experiencing continued positive shared moments rather than just resting on our laurels and thinking, you know, yeah, he told me he loved me 20 years ago. It still stands. You know, we need to kind of rekindle these moments as often as we can to make our relationship stronger.
It's not just rekindling those moments, though, is it? It's adding to them. It's finding
occurrences that's a better way.
That build it.
That's a better way to put it, yes.
That grow it. But you have mentioned that some people in your field have warned you against using the word love. Is that just because of the cultural references, or is there something more going on?
I think mostly it's the cultural references. I think the worry is, and I've certainly experienced this to some degree, is that because people have such strong pre-existing views of love, they won't be able to set those aside to take in this different perspective. And so what I've tried to make it easier is by saying, you know, it's okay for us to have our own personal definitions of love, but wouldn't it be interesting to know what your body's perspective of love is, what the physical heart's perspective of love is, what your immune cell's perspective of love is? And so what I'm trying to do is through the science is give voice to the body's experience of love and connection, and to shine a spotlight where that hasn't been much talked about before.
I want to talk again a little bit about those physical responses to love, because it sounds as though you're saying we will be healthier in general, we'll be stronger, we'll be physically more whole with greater experiences of, and let's avoid using the word love for the moment, greater moments of happiness, of
positive connection with others. Yeah. We've known for decades that people who have experiences of more positive emotions and more social connections are healthier and live longer. But one of the great mysteries of science has been to figure out, well, how is it that those feelings and those relationships get under the skin and literally make us healthier? Finding that we have with improvements in vagal tone offers one window into understanding that mystery, into seeing, oh, this is how those feelings get inside the body and affect health over the long term. And now my research team is actually looking at the cellular level. We're looking at changes in gene expression in the immune system, so getting right down to the front lines of your immune system and seeing how your white blood cells change in step with experiencing greater frequency of micromoments of positive connection.
You've done all of this research now. Why is it, do you think, that we are so obsessed with the idea of love?
You know, it's one of these really powerful psychological states that, you know, seems mysterious. You know, it feels like a lightning bolt coming down from the sky when you love at first sight, or these really intense moments of love are certainly the most memorable, but it could be that they're not the most consequential in terms of our longevity and our health. That on the spectrum of intensity, these lower intensity moments, the research has shown in the past that mild, low intensity, but frequent positive experiences are what comprise our mental and physical health the most. And so the same may be true for love. We certainly are drawn to remember and think about those intense moments and try to understand them. But the milder moments that are kind of going under the radar are the ones that may be nourishing us the most on a day-to-day basis.